So should the United States do away with the Electoral College? Yes or no? Text us, 12news.com, or tell us at 12news.com/bullhorn.
Welcome back. It's a question that comes up every 4 years, and especially after our contentious 2020 election. Can we get rid of the Electoral College?
Democrats have won the popular vote but lost the Electoral College in two of the past five elections, so you can imagine who's arguing against the Electoral College and who's for keeping it.
We've got to abolish the Electoral College. Yes. That's right. I think the way democracy works is when our elected officials come to ask everybody for their vote. Yes. And that means getting rid of the Electoral College.
That's right.
So I'm big on this.
Senator Elizabeth Warren is getting big applause lines on the campaign trail for her proposal to do away with the Electoral College entirely. The fact that a Democrat is calling for this should not be that big of a surprise. In 2016, Hillary Clinton won almost 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. In 2000, Al Gore won 500,000 more votes than George W. Bush. But because of the Electoral College, of course, they both lost the election.
So when a person casts a vote, it ought to be counted for the person for whom it's cast, and it ought to count the same as his neighbors, regardless of what state they live in. And when they're all added up, the person who wins ought to be the person that gets the most votes. I think that's a critical factor to consider.
What's old is new again, more than 40 years after Indiana Democratic Senator Birch Bayh proposed a constitutional amendment to abolish the Electoral College. A group of Democratic senators are now reviving the issue. Hawaii Democratic Senator Brian Schatz is introducing the legislation. This morning he tweeted, "Every American should be able to vote. All those votes should be counted. And the candidate who gets the most votes should become president." Senators Kirsten Gillibrand, Dianne Feinstein, Dick Durbin are also reportedly signing on to the amendment separately.
In our last video, we discussed how in the Constitution, as written, the states were given checks and balances over the federal layer of government in two ways, the Senate and the Electoral College. Both of these mechanisms have since been short-circuited. The Senate officially in the 17th Amendment. The Electoral College, however, was never officially changed. In 1824, people just stopped using it. Political parties took it over. Kind of like how a private banking cartel called the Federal Reserve took over the functions of our Treasury. Political parties are not in our Constitution. Needless to say, they're private shell companies. George Washington was adamant that we should not bring over the custom from England. He said, "However political parties may now and then answer popular ends, they are likely in the course of time and things to become potent engines by which cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men will be enabled to subvert the power of the people and to usurp for themselves the reins of government, destroying afterwards the very engines which have lifted them to unjust dominion." Democrats learned that political parties are private companies after the 2016 election when they sued due to Bernie getting more votes to be the nominee, yet the DNC installed Hillary Clinton anyway. When they litigated it, the judge handed down a ruling that disappointed them insofar as they were told that the Democratic Party was not part of the government, but was rather a private corporation. They didn't have to follow any set rules, and they could nominate a rock if they wanted to. The votes of Democrats didn't really matter. It was up to the party bosses who the nominee was. Who exactly are the party bosses? According to journalist Matt Bayh in his book, The Argument, the Democratic Party is a front company owned by three billionaire families, the Soroses, the Sandlers, and the Lewises. It's these oligarchs who choose the nominees, not the voters. As G. Edward Griffin pointed out, the oligarchs select the candidates even before the process starts, and it's only from this narrow range of pre-approved stalking horses that the average voter gets to vote on. Kind of like a mother who doesn't like her six-year-old's fashion choices and pre-selects two different outfits. She then gives the child a choice between the two, to give the child the illusion of choice, when in reality, the mother picked out both outfits. So all the power takes place at the selection process, long before the election actually takes place. According to the Constitution, it wasn't supposed to be political parties doing this. Before 1824, if you wanted to be a candidate, you went to the Electoral College and you pleaded your case before the delegate from Vermont or the delegate from Georgia or the delegate from New York. These representatives were sent out by their state legislatures. So it was the states who had the power, not George Soros. Imagine how different things would be if the states were picking our presidents. We wouldn't have things like illegal immigration due to the damage that this does to the border states. A million things would be different if we followed the Constitution and allowed the states the proper authority vested in them to pick the president. It would also take voter fraud off the table. No popular elections means no voting machines. Think of it this way. The president was supposed to be above party politics like a Supreme Court justice. They were supposed to be installed by the state legislatures, not by popular elections. The scam you see today, especially like that on display in the opening compilation clip, is the disempowering of the states, shifting the process from one regarding the states to one regarding the people. Thomas Jefferson was adamant that the Constitution was a contract between the states. See here.
Marshall's first answer on the authority of the Constitution was both simple and deceptively profound. In heart and sentiment, as well as by birth and interest, he wrote, I am an American, attached to the genuine principles of the Constitution, as sanctioned by the will of the people, for their general liberty, prosperity, and happiness. The key Marshall phrase was that the Constitution was sanctioned by the will of the people. At the time, Jefferson was challenging that fundamental premise as wrong and destructive. In his Kentucky resolutions, he contended that the Constitution's authority derived from the states, not from the people.
By getting rid of the Electoral College, as the Democrats want to do, and making it as if the people are supposed to decide, and by people, they really mean billionaire oligarchs, they're sneakily shifting power away from the states. Charles Beard talks about this early conflict on how power was supposed to be apportioned, by the states or by the people.
A government founded on states or people. The compromise. Defeated in their attempt to limit the convention to a mere revision of the Articles, the spokesmen of the smaller states redoubled their efforts to preserve the equality of the states. The signal for a radical departure from the Articles on this point was given early in the sessions, when Randolph presented the Virginia Plan. He proposed that the new national legislature consist of two houses, the members of which were to be apportioned among the states according to their wealth or free white population, as the convention might decide. This plan was vehemently challenged. Patterson of New Jersey flatly avowed that neither he nor his state would ever bow to such tyranny. As an alternative, he presented the New Jersey Plan, calling for a national legislature of one house representing states as such, not wealth or people, a legislature in which all states, large or small, would have equal voice. Wilson of Pennsylvania, on behalf of the more populous states, took up the gauntlet which Patterson had thrown down. It was absurd, he urged, for 180,000 men in one state to have the same weight in national councils as 750,000 men in another state. The gentleman from New Jersey, he said, is candid. He declares his opinion boldly. I will be equally candid. I will never confederate on his principles. So the bitter controversy ran on through many exciting sessions. Greek had met Greek. The convention was hopelessly deadlocked and on the verge of dissolution, scarce held together by the strength of a hair, as one of the delegates remarked. A crash was averted only by a compromise. Instead of a Congress of one house, as provided by the Articles, the convention agreed upon a legislature of two houses. In the Senate, the aspirations of the small states were to be satisfied, for each state was given two members in that body. In the formation of the House of Representatives, the larger states were placated, for it was agreed that the members of that chamber were to be apportioned among the states on the basis of population.
Of course, one of the liabilities of apportioning power by population, like Randolph wanted, was that it allowed people to cheat by weaponizing migration. The North in the run-up to the Civil War used mass migration to stack the deck and get more representation in the House of Representatives. Once they got that, they used the House to tax the South and siphon out all their wealth. Between 1820 and 1860, the population of the North nearly doubled. See historian Gary Gallagher talk about it here.
The North was increasing far more rapidly in population during the antebellum decades than was the South. There was more immigration, by far. The South was losing ground in population. And thus clout in Congress. The South was aware of the fact, obviously, that the North was outstripping it in population. The House of Representatives, clearly dominated by the North well before the Civil War, because, as you know, that representation based on population there. The Senate was something the South tried to maintain parity, and we'll talk about more about that in just a minute.
The reason why tensions mounted in the lead-up to the Civil War is that by 1860, 80% of the money in the U.S. Treasury was from the South. The North used its greater numbers, thanks to mass migration, to take over the House of Representatives, and thereafter, to rob the South. The South only had the Senate to try and protect themselves. The Senate was supposed to be the branch that represented the states. California is still using these techniques, via mass migration and illegal immigration. They have 6 more electoral college votes than they should have, which effectively cancels out the political power of an entire state like South Carolina. At any rate, what's happening now is that the oligarchs successfully neutralized the Senate, hence the states with the 17th Amendment. They also scammed in the Federal Reserve with the 16th Amendment, privatizing the functions of Congress and the Treasury, outsourcing it to a private banking cartel, akin to creating a Coca-Cola branch of government or a Walmart branch of government. They forgot, however, to officially neutralize the Electoral College, which remains as a potential Achilles heel, which is why they're panicking. If the state legislatures wanted to, they could reclaim their power and have the states pick the president, which would change the whole game. To their credit, the Democrats understand systems theory. According to Donella Meadows in her book, Thinking in Systems, don't expect to send a single man to Washington to get change, she says. This isn't about personalities. It's about systems. If you don't change the system, you'll change nothing. Republicans have been distracted by Trump, thinking that by sending a single man, they'll get their country back. No, the deeper truth is that you have to change the system. If you want real change, and you want real checks and balances over an out-of-control federal bureaucracy, it just may be time to do the unthinkable and follow the Constitution as written. Does it ever feel like you're not getting the full story from the media? Like there are dark and powerful forces behind the scenes manipulating national and world events? You're right on both accounts. To get the full story every time, check out Behind the Deep State, hosted by Alex Newman from The New American.